Professor Allen's Comics Reading Journal for the month of March 2019. Welcome to episode 46 of this podcast series. The concept of the show is to just have a brief chat about what comics I've read since the last time we had one of these brief chats, which should make this pretty much the books I read during March. These books are listed weekly in blog posts at eyesandearsblog.blogspot.com, and I regularly repost those links on Facebook and Twitter so you can find those. But those posts don't really count as spoilers for the podcast, because those are just lists. And here, there's a little more review, a little more critique, and a little more discussion. But first, a little feedback. And since I talked about a lot of Doctor Who comics last month, this was inevitable. Yes. We got feedback from our reigning listener of the year, Nathaniel Wayne of the Council of Geeks. Good professor. I could go over any number of things you mentioned in your latest comics reading journal, but I'm going to stay on brand and just nitpick one tiny thing that you said offhandedly, because if I didn't, I think everybody would be deeply disappointed. You labeled Frobisher, the shape-shifting penguin companion to the Doctor, as a comics-only companion. That, good sir, is not true. He's made to date one novel appearance, and two appearances in Big Finish Audio. This includes what is, as of this writing, my single favorite Big Finish story, The Holy Terror. It features Frobisher and the Sixth Doctor in a wonderful blending story of redemption, madness, perverted justice, cycles of abuse, and the power of storytelling. It is amazing, and I can't recommend it highly enough. All hail the big talking bird, but only after you're done hailing doom, of course. Geekily yours, Nathaniel Wayne of the Council of Geeks. Now, listening to that episode when it was released, I noted that it had a few little editing issues. And after receiving this email from Nathaniel, I thought maybe I should go back and fix those edits and also re-record that part and call Frobisher a comic's first character. But I let it go. And I just thank Nathaniel for the nitpickingness of his nature. That is what dysfunctional friends are for. And before I get to the comics I read this month, I did have some news to go over. Given the fact that hashtag fake news is in the pocket of Big Comic, everybody knows that, you may not have heard this story, but exciting things are happening back in Latveria, the place where I started my teaching career, the Kingdom Institute for Researching Books for Youth. Our sports teams were called the Crackles, by the way. Anyway, this fine educational organization has partnered with a newly created agency, the Latverian Education Exchange. This new joint venture, this new agency, KIRBY/LEE, or Kirby Lee. You know, some people are calling it Lee Kirby, and that's fine too. But this Kirby Lee is dedicated to bringing unabridged, truthful, honest depictions of the exploits of President for Life Victor I. So while we always say hail doom this day, we also hail the team up of Kirby and Lee. And now on to the books that I read last month, and as I do so on this show, I am categorizing the books that I read, and first are the issues I read specifically for podcast appearances, the homework books. For an upcoming episode of Back to the Bins, I brought the book Mr. District Attorney No. 39 from 1954, which the great Kanzan Gregorujo sent me a while back, and Paul Spatero brought Iron Man 25. And Dr. Bill brought, well, he's not known as Bookless Bill for nothing. So look for that conversation to be released probably sometime this month in April on the Back to the Bins feed, part, of course, of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network. And there was a comic I read for listening along with the podcast and to follow along with Aaron Moss's Headcast Network. I've picked up a number of books that he covers, including G.I. Joe, A Real American Hero, number 24, that he and a roundtable that included Jared Albrecht and Pat Sampson of the Long Box Crusade Network. They covered that on episode 24 of G.I. Joe, A Real American Headcast. Then on to the new comics that we read right off the shelves. Adventures of the Super Sons, number 8. We're still on the prison planet of Takran Galtos, and Rex Luthor is still trying to capture, or worse, our young heroes. And Luthor has bunches of prisoners now to turn into knockoffs of villains to build an evil army. So things are not going well for our boys at this point. Good read, still enjoyable. Justice League Dark, number 9. One of the things I like about this series is that once per issue, one character is given a piece of dialogue that sums up the series to this point and also the specific issue. In this case, those lines fall to Blue Demon. Is Dr. Fate a bad guy now? And after Detective Chimp answers in the affirmative, he continues, "We're all going to die, and somehow, this is all your fault, Bobo." Pretty much, that is pretty much what is happening in the series. And not only did Dr. Fate arrive and sort of become a bad guy, a handful of other Lords of Order did as well. The end is coming, and things are getting serious. Wonder Woman 65 and 66, it's taken a while, but I do see where G. Willow Wilson is taking this title. I think. And I'm not saying whether I like that or not, but I think maybe I see direction. Veronica Kale thinks she is using the goddess Nemesis, but Diana figures out that it's actually the other way around. Veronica and Diana reconcile, but the fact still is that Diana failed to protect Kale's daughter when Themyscira disappeared. So that becomes the next big quest, and then episode 66, that means bringing Giganta onto the team. I like the presence of the Amazonian personnel and beasts here in the real world. It does set Wonder Woman apart from other comics characters. At least in DC, it sort of gives her her own thing, and that can be good. But like I said before, I'm not sure that I like this specific version of that type of storytelling, at least not yet. And one that I picked up for half price at Half Price Books, but it is a pretty new comic, and that was Wonder Twins number 1 from the Wonder Comics line at DC, not quite as light as DC Superhero Girls, but pretty light and fun nonetheless. Zan and Jana are visitors to Earth, and along with having embarrassing moments at high school, they also hang out at the Hall of Justice with Wundy, Supes, and Bats. And they defeat Mixius Pidlick by themselves. It was a fun read. I may pick up the rest via Hoopla when it comes out in digital trade. I am pretty sure that I put Dial H, also from the Wonder Comics line, on the pull list. And from the good folks at Alterna, providers of new comics at the awesome price of $1.50, I read Midnight Mystery, number 3, in which our paranormal detective takes on the case of a man being haunted by his late wife, who died via a fiery suicide. And this is on the eve of his second marriage. And as a warning, I'll mention that almost the entire issue is in landscape mode, so you have to turn the comic 90 degrees sideways to read. I can hear Ed Moore right now screaming at his device for fear of what this will do to the digital version of the book. It's weird, but it does sort of make sense for the story, actually. But most importantly, no matter how you have to hold the book, the issue contained a full 32 pages of color content at that aforementioned terrific price of $1.50. and onto the general comic reading that I did, and we start with a bit of seasonal reading, if you will. And I know what you're thinking. That's usually what we do around, like, Halloween, or Veterans Day, or Christmas. But what kind of seasonal reading could one have done in March? Well, from Sir Iowa's Joe Crawford, I read Turok, Spring Break in the Lost Land. This was an insane comic story wherein a modern version of Turok, Joshua Fireseed, heads off with a few buddies for some spring break fun, and they end up four-wheeling through a lagoon, only to end up in the Lost Land, which does give Turok a chance to do some real dinosaur hunting. And dinosaur fighting. Spoilers, the team all get back safe and sound, which made for a fun one-shot story. And direct from the quarter bins at World's Greatest Comics, I read Spelljammer number 4. I read 1 through 3 a number of months ago, along with some other TSR books. This one continued the first arc of the title and did a really good job in pushing the story forward. It was a nice mix of sci-fi, fantasy, and role-playing. And I found 2 cheap, falling-apart issues featuring everybody's favorite Dark Knight detective. Batman 254 and 297. 254 was a 100-page issue featuring tales from the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s. Good stuff. And this is why coverless, falling-apart books are so awesome. There's no other way a copy of that would ever sell for 25 cents any other way. And that works for me. 297 was actually something I rarely run across. A really good Mad Hatter story. And from the anniversary sale at World's Greatest Comics, where the quarter books were discounted to 6 for a dollar, take that, Stella! I picked up a 90s book from the pages of Spider-Man, as the cover proclaimed. It was something called Annex, number 1. The character powers were okay, sort of a mech suit, but there wasn't a lot of depth, and the art was, well, it was the 90s. The less said about that, the better. And also Bold Adventures, number 1, a sci-fi anthology book from Pacific Comics from 1983. The cover story featured the Time Force, but the highlight of that story was the cool Time Force uniforms, with a very cool, dark color scheme. The best story was Anaconda, about a female spy adventurer circa the 1940s. From the dollar box at Journey into Comics, I picked up some pretty fun Bronze Age books, mostly in the broad category of About to Fall Apart, which, as I alluded to before, tend to be the best kind of Bronze Age books one can find, certainly the cheapest. For example, Savage, She-Hulk number 4 from 1980. It was about Jennifer trying to defend herself from her father, the sheriff, who is going after She-Hulk because he thinks that the Beast killed Jen. Spoilers, it has a joyous ending. Fun read. And also from there, another falling-apart Bronze Age book, Richard Dragon Kung Fu Fighter number 3 from 1975. The book had a pretty shocking credits page. Script by Denny O'Neill, and art by Jack Kirby. I had no idea that he did work on this title, and running it by the crew at the Kirby cast, they didn't either. It was basically an issue that was one long fight scene, which I usually don't like as the main part or entirety of an issue, but these guys are so good, and the surprise of unexpectedly getting a Kirby story, I really liked it. And from 1976, Marvel Classic Comics number 9, a 52-page adaptation of Bram Stoker's classic novel Dracula. Nestor Redondo did the art, and it wasn't bad. Moody, dark, creepy. Obviously, even with 50-plus pages to tell your comic story, there's a lot of abridging that has to go on here. But from what I remember of the novel, they hit the key points of the main storyline, and just as a comic book, it told its story, it hit the important parts, and it was a pretty good read overall. Dr. Anthony the Engineer sent a package around New Year's Day with a bunch of cool books in it, such as Apama, The Undiscovered Animal No. 1 from Hero Tomorrow Comics. The story takes place in Cleveland, and I'm pretty sure that's where the author of the book, Ted Sikora, is from, because I saw him at the Akron Comic-Con a few years ago when just this first issue was out. And I'm glad it crossed my path again. Thank you, Doctor. It was a fun read, a fun origin story for a modern hero from a very small press. Dr. Anthony also sent in Flash 45 from just last year. Lots of Wally West stuff in here, in addition to Damian Wayne. But I do need to give a content warning about this title. Because Barry and Iris, they kiss. And nobody told me in advance that this was going to be a kissing book. And the good doctor also sent Morte, a 2017 one-shot from Sourcepoint Comics. It is a silent issue, okay, there's one word spoken, about how the one living person at the end of the world spends his day. It's pretty beautifully presented and a really cool little story. And Higher Earth, number one, this was clearly the first chapter of a story, and I didn't get attached enough to it, or to the characters, to really feel like I need to follow it to its succeeding issues. And long-term friend of the network, Ron Sadowski, one of the very earliest members of the hashtag comic book circle of life, also sent a care package during the holiday season. And that included Black Canary, number 3, from the 1991-92 miniseries. It's a classic situation of part 3 of a 4-part story where the plot doesn't advance a whole lot, but not a bad read, and I don't mind Trevor Von Eden's art here as much as some do. And from the generous Canadian Sir Rob Lance, I read What If 19 and 27 from the first run of that title, 1980 and 1981. These were What If Spider-Man Had Never Become a Crime Fighter, which was really good, and What If Phoenix Had Not Died, which, well, I don't really have enough background with the X-Men to tell if that was a good story or not. If you have strong feelings about that, let me know. But the Spider-Man one, again, was very good, with Spidey becoming a Hollywood mogul, with JJJ still as his mortal enemy. I liked the notion of a character getting powers, and then just living a sort of more or less human, normal human life, not becoming a hero or a villain. That little touch, that little bit of story, actually quite worked for me. Rob Lance also sent in a book that was released when I wasn't even 1 year old yet, Metamorpho number 7, in which the Element Man battles an evil volcanologist. Are there really any other kinds? To rescue his potential father-in-law, Simon Stagg, with the help of, well, mostly help of, the beautiful Sapphire Stagg and Stagg's ape-headed assistant, Java. With the exception of some crazy, groovy dialogue from our hero, talking to Stagsy and Saffy Baby, I really enjoyed this. And good use was made of the elemental powers, and that, you know, doesn't always happen. And between Sir Rob Lance and the Quarter Bins at World's Greatest Comics, I read a pair of related books, Classics Illustrated, 75 and 141. Both of these, interestingly enough, were adaptations of works by Sir Walter Scott, The Lady of the Lake, and Castle Dangerous. Lady of the Lake was a bit of a tough read, as it was an epic poem, so in that one the pictures were often just giving voice to the poem. In some panels we just had a profile of a talking person, for example, mouthing the words of the poem. But Castle Dangerous was more of a typical adventurous story of knights and medieval war, and there the artist had a chance to portray the story in a much more action-packed way. I see some of these at times in cheap bins, and I think I need to be more aggressive about pulling them out and giving them a read. Sir I Was Joe sent in some books recently, including a Marvel book from last year, The End of a Series, Royals, number 12. This is about the Inhuman royal family and the aftermath of Medusa destroying the world's supply of Terrigen. I've read some other of Al Ewing's writings, and generally, I like what he does. And this was pretty good, although I don't have much idea about what's going on here. But note that this is not the last time you'll hear about the Inhumans in this episode. And some kids' books I read, some from Sir Rob, some from the Quarterbin, some from Ron Sadowski, and some from my brother-in-law, Phil, who we visited this month. He and his father, my father-in-law, will be moving here to Central Ohio in a few months, and we visited in Richmond, Virginia, to help them clean out their house prior to that move. And I cleaned out some of its comic books, if you know what I'm saying. So, overall, the kids' books that I read included Archie, Weird Mysteries 1, Betty and Veronica 172 and 345, Betty and Me 26, 128, 160, and 169, Baby Huey 83, The Tales from Riverdale Digest number 25, and Swingin' with Scooter number 34. The Tales from Riverdale story that featured Dilton Doily being taken over by a black, liquidy type of entity that he created. And when it does take him over, he starts wearing dark clothes, dark washed jeans, a jean jacket. That's right. This is the story of Denim. No, it actually was, and it wasn't all that bad. And I have certainly never read an issue of Swing with Scooter before, and the likenesses to the Archie characters seem to me that they had to border on some sort of copyright infringement. But the side stories, the backups, are much better than Archie's sometimes can be. Let me just say, you can keep your little Jinx. I'll take Penny and her cross-eyed pussycat. Okay, well, let's take a break here. When we come back, we'll talk about the graphic novels, trades, and long runs that I read during March.
In 1975, Jaws was released. It is routinely regarded as one of the greatest films of all time and is generally credited with creating the concept of the summer blockbuster. In 1978, in an obvious cash grab, Jaws 2 was released, failing to have lightning strike a second time, but presenting a generally enjoyable film. In 1983, Jaws 3D was released, shamelessly attempting to take advantage of a gullible audience. By 1987, there was no pretense of quality as Lorraine Gary and Michael Caine cashed paychecks for sleepwalking through a pointless and incredulous sequel. In 2016, Paul Spitero created Is It Jaws?, in which he and a group of rotating guest hosts discuss new and old movies and place them up against the Jaws scale, which ignores some elements of the actual films and sets forth a rating scale. Jaws, an all-time great classic film. Jaws 2, an enjoyable film with some flaws but worthy of multiple viewings. Jaws 3, a moderately enjoyable film. And finally, Jaws 4, a bad movie. Please join Paul and his guests as they ask the ever-important question, is it Jaws?
And we're back to talk about trades, long runs, and miniseries that I read last month. And we start with the end of February. This segment wraps up our 6 or 7 week-long crossover, in which every show on the network talked about Doctor Who. And as for this show's participation, that meant I read some more Doctor Who comics. Not as many as last month, but still a pretty good amount, including some that were sent in to me late last year by Countess Ruth and Count Darren of the Sutherlands. And I took this opportunity to read them. No. These next ones are all from the Year 3 run of these titles, the 10th Doctor number 7, 11th Doctor, number 7, and 12th Doctor, number 4. Of these, I like the 11th and 12th the most, both of which are written by George Mann. I really like Alice, the 11th Doctor's comic book companion, and the story of the 12th, focused on the power of music, especially loud music, especially punk, so it hit on Capaldi's past as well. I also read Doctor Who, the 12th Doctor, Year 3, 7, and 9, and yes, that is a mouthful. I'm pretty sure the Sutherlands also sent me these two issues, and I took them with me to Gallifrey 1, because Richard Dinnick was going to be there, the writer, and he kindly signed my books to Professor Allen. Although he did have a little problem spelling my first name on one, so I mentioned that I was, in fact, an actual professor, and I could grade his efforts. But he did it for me. So the cover of issue 7 says, "For Professor Allen, Richard Dinnick, C-. Now, for issue 9, he did not have to grade the cover, but we agreed that he would have earned an A+ on that. And the story inside number 9 also comes pretty close to earning an A+. It had the Doctor, Bill Potts, and Nardole heading off to the universe's largest shopping mall for a really fun one-off story. One of the things I like about Titan's handling of the Doctor Who license is that even though they issue their trades at 5-issue intervals, 3 trades per season, they don't have all of those stories run 5 issues. Now, a storyline will often end at issue 5, or 10, or 15, but those 5-issue trades may be made up of a 2-issue story and a 3-issue story, or a 4-issue story and a one-off. It's whatever combination they come up with, that adds up to 5. And so there is room for one-off stories, like issue 9 did in that run. I also read Doctor Who, The Road to the 13th Doctor, 1 through 3. It's an interesting approach for the intro of the Jodie Whittaker Doctor, because these issues don't actually intro that Doctor. It's more of an introduction to the creative team who's going to be writing the 13th Doctor series, including Jodie Hauser and Rachel Stott, who were also at Gallifrey 1. So this is 3 one-off stories featuring, in order, the 10th, 11th, and 12th Doctors. Good stories, like I said. An interesting way to introduce, again, not necessarily the new Doctor, but at least to introduce the creators who will be doing that new Doctor series. Speaking of which, Doctor Who, the 13th Doctor, 0 to 3. I thought it only fair to read some of these, especially after reading that Road 2 miniseries. And the 0 issue was the extra-sized intro to the Whittaker Doctor with a narrative musing on regeneration interspersed with 2 to 3 to 4 pages from each of the other Doctors. And each of those scenes were done by a different artist. And doing that in Doctor Who really works. Sometimes that doesn't work in comic books and having different art styles throughout the book. But for Doctor Who, it works because it gives a good visual sense of how each of those Doctors, although the same character, differs from each other. So that was the many lives of Doctor Who, that 0 issue. It was solid and definitely laid the groundwork for the actual ongoing title. And the first actual arc of 13 has Team TARDIS chasing a mysterious temporal portal, discovering a man trapped in a time loop. He has one of those hinky vortex manipulators, think Captain Jack, which makes the Doctor more than a little suspicious. This fella has a colleague in the vortex, and even though everyone is certain there's more going on than it appears, they do agree to help. And then he tries to commandeer the TARDIS, and all of this action attracts the attention of the Army of the Just. Not a bad story, good solid SF, good characterization of 13. Unfortunately, one way the book resembles the TV show is it doesn't give very much for Yaz to do, and doesn't give Ryan a whole lot more either. And then we come to related books, not Who specific, but written by the veteran Doctor Who writer Paul Cornell. I don't know if I've ever mentioned this on a podcast, but I had dinner with Paul Cornell one night at the Gallifrey One convention. I know, I try to keep that information pretty close to the chest, but thought I'd mention it here. You know, just mention it once. Not a big deal. Well, after hanging out Paul Cornell at the con, I decided to dive into a series of his that I'd heard good things about and read Saucer Country 1 through 14, which was a Vertigo title from 2012 and 2013. This is the entire run of that title, in which New Mexico Governor Arcadia Alvarado is running for her party's nomination for president. And just as she wraps up the nomination, is preparing for the general election, she gathers her core advisors and reveals one basic little fact about her that they all need to know. A little thing that happened to her that I like to call alien abduction. And that is one of her leading drives in running for the presidency, to find out everything the feds know about aliens and abduction and all of that. And it turns out that she's not the only person in the cast of characters who's had a similar experience, one of which involves fairy-like tiny little people. So there are lots of weird things happening in this, but the mystery is how much of it is actually happening. Because we have conspiracy theories, men in black, all that sort of stuff. And it's really well written, with the little exception of Cornell taking a few shortcuts with the American electoral process, which bumped me a little bit every now and then. This was a really enjoyable, really well put together story. Then, after a layoff of about 4 years and a publisher change to IDW, Cornell continued the story of, spoilers, President Alvarado in Saucer State 1 through 6. And now, with more power, Arcadia is able to dig into what the Federales really know about aliens, all the way from Roswell up to the current day. But even with access to all the official info, the mystery just keeps getting deeper. Now, unfortunately, there hasn't been a new issue released in the last year or so, and this trade does end on a cliffhanger. So I have a feeling for what's going on in the story, what's true and not true, but I would like to see Cornell actually have a chance to wrap it up sometime. So I will have to keep my eyes open for more Saucer State. And that is all of our February content for the month, officially bringing the network-wide crossover to an end, which means that sadly for me, and joyfully for M, I won't ever have a reason to say February ever again. And that does bring us to the rest of the miniseries, long runs and trade paperbacks that I read in March. And we start with a trade that I picked up because I saw that it was becoming a Netflix show and wanted to read the series before I watched the program. And it struck my memory that Sir Iowa's Joe had sent me a couple of issues of this. And with those, along with the Hoopla app, I read Umbrella Academy Apocalypse Suite 1 through 6. Fascinating story, taking the idea of the school for powered people in a really different direction. That is one nice thing about independent comics. They can go totally different directions. You don't need to follow traditional superhero tropes. Not that there's anything wrong necessarily with those tropes, with the long-term soap opera mode of traditional superhero comic book storytelling. But I also like stories that are able to counter those things, that run contrary to those. And I like the Umbrella Academy premise, that there was the small, finite number of strange babies born under strange circumstances, and then only a small number of them actually became known via the Academy. And the first story, Apocalypse Suite, picks up many years later. So we skip the Harry Potter stuff, or the magician's stuff, the stories from the school, from growing up. But during the course of this story, we do infer some facts about those relationships and about those pasts, and I appreciate that type of storytelling. There is a second trade that's available and a third one that's currently being published. So I will check Hoopla for that second one. And I expect to read that next month. And then maybe jump into the TV show, which I've also heard pretty decent stuff about. Good buddy Mark Sweeney of the On Long-Term Hiatus podcast, I'm the Gun, sent a care package recently, including the entirety of a 1995 miniseries, Triumph 1 through 4. This is a hero that never was character, who in a past that nobody recalls but him, was one of the founders of the JLA. He brought those founders together, but Zero Hour wiped his memory from everyone. It's an interesting idea, but I don't know that the character really needed to continue beyond Zero Hour to try to make him something. This is well written, written by Christopher Priest, and it's, again, it's an intriguing idea. But I had trouble 20 plus years later trying to be convinced that this was a very important character. So I never really got into it, but I don't think it was, you know, bad in any way. And this character really just hasn't been seen in more than a decade, or in terms of DC history, many continuities ago. My wife and I visited her father and brother in Virginia over spring break, and in addition to loading up my phone with Hoopla digital comics and books, I also brought with me a showcase that I picked up from Ollie's last year, and had gotten maybe a third of the way through it back then. So I grabbed it off the shelf, tossed it in the backpack, and read Challengers of the Unknown, 4 through 8, all from the Jack Kirby and Wally Wood days of the late 1950s. That is a lot of comic book talent, and more often than not, these stories lived up to that. A couple of these were full-lengthers, but mostly an issue had two 12-page stories. Both formats had good stories, with The Wizard of Time from issue 4 probably my favorite. I like that June was included about every other issue, it seems. And yes, sometimes she needed rescuing, but more often than not, she was pretty helpful to the team. So I really love sci-fi from this era, be it in prose or in comic books, and this really just reinforced that love. Very solid stuff. And I just mentioned Mark Sweeney from I'm the Gun. He also sent a Mature Reader series from James Robinson and Tom Feister, Grand Passion 1 through 5. It's about a couple of robbers, who are also a couple, who hit a bank in a small town, and the male of the couple dies at the hands of one of the sheriff deputies, a man who knows he's kind of a misfit in his department. But something strange happens at the crime scene. The deputy and the female robber, the one who survives, fall madly in love at first sight. It is a crazy setup for a crazy story, but Robinson does tell it very, very well. A few months back, I read some Spider-Woman and commented that if I ever saw some more for cheap, I'd pick them up. And I did. From half-price books at a buck each, I found some issues from the 2015 run from the Spider-Verse era, Spider-Woman 2 through 4. The place I learned about Spider-Verse, about the Inheritors and Morlun, etc., was actually from the Spider-Man Unlimited iOS game, or, as I should say, the late lamented Spider-Man Unlimited iOS game. Because this was part of an event Spider-Verse, there was action in between the issues and other Spider titles, but I give writer Dennis Hopeless a lot of credit for making each of these issues still stand on its own. Between narrative captions or dialogue, you're able to figure out what had happened in the other series, and so these issues were able to focus on Jessica Drew and her crew, her side of the Spider-Verse event. We get multiple versions of Jessica from multiple realities, including a pirate queen, as well as Silk and Spider-Gwen, and we even get some Captain Marvel. And having Carol there as a friend of Jessica led me into some other books that I found. From the 50-cent box at Pulp Reality, I found from the 2016 run, Spider-Woman 2 and 4. This is from when Jessica was very, very, very pregnant, and based on the recommendation of her good buddy, Carol Danvers, she headed to a maternity ward run by Alpha Flight, only to find it overrun by Skrulls. Jessica does what she can to defend herself and the other pregnant ladies there, despite her physical situation. And then Carol shows up, and everything's good, except that they end up stranded in an actual black hole. And spoilers, by the end of issue 4, Jessica's delivered a supposedly, hopefully, healthy and human baby boy. And longtime friend of the network, Ron Sadowski, sent some comics in recently, including The New Warriors, 1 and 14, from 1990 and 1991, Namorita, Kid Nova, Speedball, Night Thrasher, Firestar, and Marvel Boy? So yeah, not exactly A-listers. And obviously that's the pitch, that these lesser-known and slightly underpowered heroes, when you combine them into a team, you get... well, you get the New Warriors. Of these, the only character I really liked was Namorita. I thought they got her sense of being lost between two worlds very well, and her interactions with Namor were very strong. And they were fun enough, but nothing earth-shattering in these issues. I think I can sum up my thoughts on these two by a phrase that actually appears on the cover of issue 1. Heroes for the 90s. Yep. And I read a handful of books from my stack featuring a certain God of Thunder, which came to me courtesy of the great Canadian Sir Rob Lance and Clinton Robinson. Marvel Spectacular, which reprinted Thor 135, and Mighty Thor 227 and 396. Clinton gets a special shout-out for sending in the copy of 396, which literally fell apart in my hands as I read it. And that's a good thing. The earliest one, which was a reprint from the Kirby and Lee era, was terrific. I am certain that the story ran roughshod over actual Norse legend and religion, but the Thor and Loki and Odin relationships are such a great story engine. And when you get Kirby drawing that stuff off in another realm, it's pretty great. 227 is solid as well, with Thor and Hercules having to team up with Fire Lord, and Galactus makes an appearance as well, to battle Ego, the living planet. Ego is a crazy concept, a character who looks crazy, but is a formidable foe. And that one also had some great Odin and Asgard bits. My good buddy and regular guest on the network, Luke Giaconetti, from the excellent Earth Destruction Directive podcast and others, sent a fun care package recently, which included the rest of a series that I read the first issue of last year from Dynamite Entertainment from 2015, Justice Inc., The Avenger 2 through 6. This is Mark Waid's take on the 30s pulp adventurer, or more specifically, Mark Waid's take on Doc Savage. I remember not being in love with the first one, as I thought it may have bordered on parody more than homage, but having read these, I do see more of a love letter to the era and to that type of story, and even to this specific character, than I found just reading issue 1. I did not know that this was an existing pulp character, so I think I can forgive the similarities, saying that this was an actual example of 30s pulp adventure, not just Waid's take on that character, though it was that as well. Pretty good adventure stories, really tied in the period era concepts and the genre conventions as well. I did enjoy having the whole series more than I did just that first issue. Our buddy Jason Marcinet from the Drawn and Paneled podcast sent in some Rebirth era books recently. These were Superwoman 2, Supergirl Rebirth, and issue 1, Nightwing 7, and Superman 8 and 9. I had not read any of the Superwoman title before, and I didn't like this one a ton, although the Lena Luthor appearance at the end intrigued me. As far as Supergirl goes, I did like the similarities to the setup on the TV show, the DEO, the Danvers as Cat Grant. And I thought it was interesting that she was from a society so far advanced that she actually struggled with some things in high school. That was a nice touch and a bit of fish out of water that you don't necessarily see a lot of. That was probably the strength of those issues. The best reads of the batch were definitely the two Superman books. These are from the Tomasi and Gleason run. And in this pair of issues, 8 and 9, Superman and his son John get sucked through a portal to Dinosaur Island, where they find the graves of the losers, along with a surviving Captain Storm. The three of them recover the piece of machinery that they need to get them all back to the current day, and Superman and John do make it back. And in a really nice bit, Captain Storm chooses to stay behind, declaring that the losers always stick together. Really well done little arc. Thoroughly enjoyed those two issues. We mentioned Dr. Anthony the Engineer earlier. His most recent care package included a run from another Dynamite title that takes a pulpy character from the Golden Age and reinterprets them for today. In this case, it's Miss Fury 1 through 3 from 2013, which was a series that ran 11 issues. From what I can tell, the character was a newspaper feature in the 1940s. This storyline has the title character Marla Drake, daughter of a rich businessman, and she's also a top-of-the-line jewel thief and occasional hero. She's jumping back and forth between 1943 and 2013. Maybe it's a dream. Maybe it's actual time travel. Maybe we'll find out more later in the arc. But whatever it is, Miss Fury spends 1943 fighting German saboteurs in Manhattan who want to extend their Nazi dominance of Europe to the U.S. And in 2013, she is battling the ensconced Nazi regime that evidently won World War II. Good character, good story, well written by Rob Williams. And I have to give Dr. Anthony the Engineer credit for sending me some awesome covers, because each of these issues had multiple covers. But he sent me one cover by Alex Ross, who I'm a big fan of, and two covers by Joe Benitez, the creator of one of my favorite characters, Lady Mechanica. So great-looking covers, pretty good-looking interiors, and overall, solid, fun issues. And from Hoopla, I read the next volume of a series I've really been enjoying, and spoilers, this volume is no exception. Scooby-Doo Team-Up 25 through 30 continues Sholly Fish's excellent work, delivering fun and funny stories that more than once poke a little bit of fun at the comics world. There are four legitimately very good stories in this volume. One's featuring the hard-traveling heroes, Hong Kong Phooey, Jonah Hex, and the Challengers of the Unknown. Not to say that the ones with Top Cat and Plastic Man weren't bad by any means. They just weren't as excellent as those other four. So each of these four had legitimately laugh-out-loud moments, such as Green Arrow's Chili being too hot for even Shaggy and Scooby, or Daphne being constantly reminded how much she looks like Cinnamon, or how similar the makeup of so many teams are. The Scooby Gang, the Sea Devils, Cave Carson and his crew, the Challengers. And of course, in every issue, Fred suggests pulling the mask off the bad guy to find out who they really are. And once, I'm not going to spoil which issue this is the case in, but once, the bad guy is actually an evil real estate developer. And not just the jokes and the funny, but the stories themselves are actually pretty good. There's usually enough plot to keep the story moving, so it's not just excuses to get from joke to joke. but the stories unto themselves are pretty good. A terrific read, a really fun read. Also, from Hoopla, I picked up a trade featuring a hero team I mentioned in the first half of the show. Do you remember? Were you paying attention? From the late 90s, it's The Inhumans 1 through 12, which was an Eisner Award-winning series. And I gotta agree with that assessment. This is really, really good. The basic plot is that the world of humans are finally sick and tired of the Dome City of Adalan and the Inhumans and their refusal to interact with the rest of the world. So having gotten some inside information from a secret source inside Adalan, spoilers, it's Maximus the Mad. The humans are able to actually penetrate the land's impenetrable defenses, and the stoic King Black Bolt, well, he refuses to do anything. So there's a lot of tension, a lot of drama in the story. It's excellent. And Paul Jenkins tells the story from different characters, points of views in some of the issues. Could be Maximus, or Crystal, or one issue, even Lockjaw. I've always liked the Inhumans, the Inhuman royal family in particular. But a lot of that is in theory, because I haven't read a ton of their stories, especially stories where they're the lead characters, like this one. So I'm really glad I read this. Again, very, very good. And I think that's everything. In terms of my favorite reads of the month, those Challengers of the Unknown stories from the 50s are tough to beat. Saucer Country was really, really good. Justice League Dark was a fun read. And some of those Inhumans issues were very, very close. Other months, the winner would have come from that book. Maybe issue 1, maybe issue 12, maybe the Lockjaw issue. Lots of good issues in that Inhumans run. But in terms of my favorite issues of the month, it was actually pretty clear-cut. The best trade I've read in a while is the Scooby-Doo team-up. 6 issues, 4 of which could stake a claim to being the best story of the month, but I'm going with Scooby-Doo team-up number 30 with all of the various teams, Challengers of the Unknown, Sea Devils, etc. That was a terrific story. Best read of the month. And next month, like I said, I'm going to knock out the second Umbrella Academy trade, and I picked up a bunch of books from the 50-cent boxes at Pulp Reality. I'm going to dig through some of those. But whatever I do end up reading in April, I will be here to talk about them next episode. And that episode ought to be out sometime in early May. Feel free to let me know what you think of this episode, what you think of any of these books that I've mentioned, especially if you've read any of them. You can send that feedback in via email at relativelygeeky@gmail.com or as a comment on the Facebook and blog post for this episode. The blog is at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com. You can follow the network on Twitter at relatively_geek. And of course, the network has its own page on Facebook as well. Come join us. All are welcome. Thanks for listening, and keep the pages turning.